You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, the saga continues, but will the Demos tire of it? As Greece and a chorus of creditors line up rival proposals to ward off still further crisis, my guests Isabel Hilton and James Schneider are with me to give their views on an ongoing financial drama with very real consequences. And as he starts a new term, Sudan's returning president says he's open to dialogue with the West. A shame that the West want him for war crimes. We ask what's next for al-Bashir and how can he be held to account. Also ahead, we'll discuss the ongoing fight against Boko Haram as Niger's president says a multinational force to combat the group will soon be up and running. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine. We will start, before we move on to the programme, with some breaking news. It has been announced in the last few minutes that Sepp Blatter, the embattled, if not outright beleaguered, president of FIFA, will step down just days after being re-elected to a fifth term in defiance of all common sense. He says he will stay in power until an extraordinary Congress can be arranged, which will elect a new president. This, of course, comes slightly less than a week after the FBI raided a hotel in Zurich and arrested several of his colleagues. Just a brief reaction from each of you. James, is there anything much to be said about this beyond good?
No, not really. Yay!
Isabel, can you elaborate on yay,
well,
as James put it?
Well, I can speculate completely wildly on what triggered it. So
please do.
Two things occur to me. One, that the sponsors, the money started to run away. I mean, it's not that good for Western sponsors to be associated with Sepp Blatter. That might have counted. And the other, I guess, is that, you know, the feds are onto him too, and that there is some advanced warning of an imminent arrest.
Yeah, James, just a final thought on this. We will be discussing this topic in greater detail on the Daily at 2200 hours tonight. This obviously is by no means the end to the saga. I mean, who's going to want the job at this point? Of course, Tony Blair's looking for work.
That was my first thought. Not that Tony Blair would take it up, but who would want the job? It would be...
trusted with money, of course.
It was going to be an absolute nightmare cleaning up this actually rather important global institution.
It really is. But anyway, much more to come on that later tonight on The Daily, and I'm sure on Monocle 24 throughout the coming days. I suspect this circus has not yet left town. We will proceed, therefore, with the rest of tonight's show, and we will start with Greece. Now, if it was a private company, the procedure from here would be relatively straightforward. Load up on the insurance and plan a fire for next Thursday. But Greece is a country with a population of 11 million people, which will remain obstinately attached to Europe, at least physically, whatever happens. Today, following yet another emergency summit last night in Berlin, Greece has proposed yet another scheme for dealing with its debts, and yet another counteroffer from its creditors is anticipated. Isabel, I'll ask you first, is this actually going to end before the Earth finally spins into a dying sun, extinguishing all life on this planet?
Doesn't seem likely, does it?
Not really.
I mean, the problem is nobody wants it to end. Everybody wants it to end and nobody wants it to end. So one way to end it is a default, but Greece doesn't want that and neither does Europe. On the other hand, they have diametrically opposed positions. You know, we have a government in Greece which was elected on no austerity, no external supervision, and you have the other side which is insisting on austerity and external supervision. So they're going to find some way to kick the can down the road a little further and go on trying. I don't think that there's any magic bullet here.
James, the whole thing keeps making me think of a quote usually attributed to the economist Herbert Stein, who I suspect I'm paraphrasing somewhat when he said, when something can't go on, it won't. Have we got there yet?
It doesn't look like we've quite got there yet. I mean, no one outside the people who know, which is sadly none of us in this, none of this in this room, know precisely the state of Greek public finances, so we don't know quite how long it will go on for. But exactly as Isabel's saying, both sides, it's really in their interest to try to kick the can down the road, because the creditors hope that the government falls or becomes unpopular and they can put more pressure, whilst the government is trying to appeal over the heads of the IMF, over the heads of the European Central Bank, to either European politicians or the European public more generally, so it can receive more support on its arguments based on, as it would see, justice. And so it suits them as well to try to build up that support, even though they're not really getting it.
At least one news source covering the talks is quoting official sources, official Greek sources, saying that Greece will make this IMF payment that's due on Friday after previously suggesting that they couldn't. Isabel, that means, or at least it strikes me that means that either they were bluffing or that the government in Athens hasn't actually got the least idea what it's doing. Which of those two explanations strikes you as more plausible?
I suppose it's the third possibility, that somebody's handed them an envelope in the back of the car with just enough to make
it would
the IMF.
Need to be a big envelope.
It would
envelope.
Be quite a big envelope. But you could take another view and say it's actually much better for Greece to default. If you remember what happened when Argentina defaulted, the largest sovereign debt in history, sovereign default, and it was pandemonium for about 6 months. It was extraordinary being in a country where there was no money. Money didn't work anymore. 40% of the country went over to barter, and people became very adept and sophisticated about barter because you couldn't get money. But then Argentina recovered because essentially it kind of wiped out, most of its debt. It has a little problem with external credit, but Argentina did recover. That option isn't open to Greece without the other consequences of leaving the euro. Argentina was tied to the dollar. The dollar didn't care. But Greece tied to the euro. The euro does care.
I mean, there is, of course, a long history of countries defaulting, devaluing their currency, trading their way back into solvency. Iceland has sort of done it relatively recently. Several Scandinavian nations did it in the early to mid-90s. It just strikes me, James, knowing as little about economics as I do, that would seem the sensible option for Greece. But why won't the rest of Europe let Greece go?
Well, there are two different questions there. One, for Greece, would it be sensible? It is an option.
I'm not saying it's an easy one.
No,
seems like the least appalling of the options facing.
Well, I think that's the case, and possibly Varoufakis and Tsipras are keeping the threat of that slightly in their back pocket as the left of their party does push more firmly for that, and it can help them in negotiations. Because yes, at some point, having their own currency and leaving and doing it somewhat more on their own terms is better than some of the other options, but not all of the other options. But then from the EU, core EU perspective, it damages the project if any entity leaves the euro. It makes them look more fragile, and it looks like the tide of history that everyone was very triumphant about, if we think just 10 years ago, about the EU was always going to expand, everyone was going to join the euro, and there was going to be this wonderful norm-producing positive economic force. Well, that looks slightly challenged if countries can just drop out entirely.
It strikes me as a perfectly plausible analysis, but Isabel, is that enough? And couldn't the EU spin that the other way? Couldn't the EU say this is, frankly, a club for solvent, well-managed, well-run, honest, accountable countries, and Greece is not one of those?
It could, although I have to say the membership would be rather smaller if it did that. Would Italy be in it? Would Spain be in it? It's not just Greece, and to be fair to Greece, a lot of its problems derive from being in the euro. It hasn't had the flexibility to manage its own currency. It's been tied to Germany's ferocious output. It's been able to buy Germany's exports on the same currency level. And all of this is unviable for an economy like Greece. So it didn't invent its own problems, though it may have made them worse.
That final point is really very important, as why German manufacturing doesn't want to lose the south. It doesn't want to pay for the south of Europe, but it can't lose the south of Europe, because being in the same currency union is essentially a subsidy, or it reduces the costs of German exports to the south. So the south can load up on debt, and that gets paid to German and other northern industrial exporters. So it is in their interest. If they just become the small club, then they don't get those benefits.
Okay, well, we'll move along to our next subject. I suspect we will be discussing Greece and the Euro probably next week, next month, 6 months from now, this time next year, etc., etc. Last Friday in Abuja, Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, made a statement of intent about the struggle against Boko Haram, the Islamist insurgency responsible for at least 13,000 deaths in the last 6 years. He said he would move the military command centre of the war from Nigeria's capital to Maiduguri, Boko Haram's birthplace. Since then, Boko Haram attacks on that very town have killed at least 53 people, including dozens today after a marketplace was targeted in a suicide bombing, which would appear to have borne all the hallmarks of the group. James, you've just been in Cameroon, correct, watching the fight against Boko Haram from that end. How does it appear to be progressing?
Well, from the Cameroonian side, it's progressing reasonably well. They look like they've got pretty well-trained, well-armed and fairly effective special forces who are running around and dealing with the problem there. But the main problem is, of course, in Nigeria. And actually, Nigeria and Cameroon aren't really cooperating at all. In fact, they're not cooperating at all on this issue. Tomorrow, Buhari is going...
Sorry, just to pick you up on that point, why aren't they cooperating? They would appear to have at least a common enemy.
Yes, but they have a history of distrust. They've fought over the Bekasi Peninsula in the southeast of Nigeria, to the northwest of Cameroon, or sort of west of Cameroon. And they don't like each other. No one will really go on the record, and although I was trying to press people to say precisely what it is that is the red line that will not allow them to have any engagement with one another. But there's no Cameroonian forces can't cross over to the Nigerian border or vice versa, even if in hot pursuit of Boko Haram. There's zero intelligence sharing. And tomorrow, Buhari is going to Chad and to Niger to talk about how they're fighting Boko Haram. He's not going to go to Cameroon.
Just sticking with you on this, James, it does seem like a fairly peculiar state of affairs. Is there not, or does someone like Buhari, calling him a newcomer to the presidency is not entirely accurate. He has had a go at this, but he is somebody with credentials as a military man. He was a former general. Is he not able somehow to, at least on this issue, reach out to President Biya and Yaounde and say, okay, we may not like each other, our countries may not like each other, we do have a common problem?
Well, he may do. From being with the Cameroonian Special Forces, they really didn't know what they thought Buhari would do next. They thought that, quite understandably, Buhari is a nationalist, and he doesn't like and has made negative statements about the fact that Nigerian and Chadian forces has had to come into Nigeria to tackle Boko Haram. And in 1983... just before he became president, he did, as a general, chase out Chadian forces from Borno State. So he's unlikely to want to allow them in too much. But if he can mobilise, or someone can help them mobilise, at least some degree of intelligence sharing and a bit more cooperation, even if it isn't allowing the Cameroonians to cross the border, that will make the fight easier and better against Boko Haram.
Isabel, to bring you in on this, is there at least something encouraging in the degree of cooperation, somewhat dysfunctional though it is, that exists among the West African countries? Does there appear to be at least a recognition that it will require collective effort to dispense with Boko Haram?
I think absolutely, and I think it's also encouraging that Nigeria at least appears to be taking proactive position on this. I've certainly felt that the previous administration was pretty passive on Boko Haram. So we'll see. I mean, getting multinational forces to operate effectively is always a challenge, but we can only hope that it begins to have an effect.
Is there an argument for, to the extent that there is a military solution here, James, do the West African militaries, if they cooperate, do they have it covered? Or is there any kind of argument for, indeed call for, forces from outside West Africa?
No, they should be able to have it covered. There are serious downsides. So there's, I was in a refugee camp on Thursday in Cameroon for Nigerian refugees, and not all of them had fled Boko Haram. Quite a lot of them had fled atrocities committed by the Nigerian army. And there's a report coming out tomorrow by Amnesty International, which I'm led to believe will lay out a lot of the human rights abuses that the Nigerian army has pursued. But in terms of pure military capabilities, yes, the four countries, if they're operating together, if they're sharing some intelligence, if they know, if the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, should be able to defeat Boko Haram's main ability to hold territory and fight. As a terrorist organisation that can carry out the bombings like it did this morning in Maiduguri, that's a different question.
Isabel, as a general principle, and this has now been a dominating theme of current affairs for the last few years now, reaching all the way from West Africa to the Middle East, of tackling non-state Islamist insurgencies, which appear as really not to have even the beginnings of any sort of actually negotiable, coherent political agenda. In fact, give often just every impression of just being motivated by utter nihilism. Are we actually learning anything about dealing with them at all?
Well, I think we've learned that you can't fight them from afar, that if local forces are not both committed and competent, then you make no progress. But also, as James said, that what alienates people, what drives them either to tolerate or support these insurgencies, can be something quite other than an attachment to Islamism. And I think we see that in many of these countries, that, you know, you have in Iraq, for instance, you have tribes that are alienated from the government, which tolerate, therefore, if not support, an Islamic insurgency. But that doesn't mean that the situation can't be recovered. It just means that I think that our characterization of these insurgencies is too crude. It doesn't differentiate one from the other, and we've taken the wrong approach to date. But I think that people are learning.
I also think that we have to recognise that these insurgencies, they change over time, and the way in which one can deal with them changes over time. So if you look at Boko Haram in, let's say, 10 years ago, but they could have been dealt with somewhat, as in some kind of negotiations in terms of the amount of Sharia law that would take place in some states of Nigeria, with some aspects of funding for religious schools and so on and so forth. There's something you could do there. Then as they become a bit more radical after the clampdown on them and the killing of their leader in 2009, you could say, well, we'll release certain prisoners. There's certain things you can negotiate with. But then as it becomes more radical, and now where the majority of the fighters are, you know, 15-year-old children who are given tramadol to go and fight and are paid $150 to attack a village, then you've left the realms of something that you can negotiate with. And it's also something that isn't purely ideological either. You've got this other thing which is feeding on itself, and it's feeding on the local community where it can, and then you have to deal with it in a different manner.
So just on that final thought, which is a depressing but astute summary of the way these things can mutate over time, is there a political maneuver open to the government of Nigeria which might, if not actually negotiate successfully with Boko Haram, because that's probably not terribly possible at the moment or indeed desirable, might actually leech away from them whatever support they may have? Are there options on that front?
There's an enormous amount of work that the Nigerian military has to do to make quite a lot of the population of northeast Nigeria not afraid of it. And that is going to take a lot of time. And until you can do that, until you can convince them that, one, you will protect them if they're under attack. I met lots of people who said that we knew Boko Haram were coming. We went 10 kilometres away. We told the local military installation. They did nothing. They left us to fight Boko Haram on our own with our homemade guns and our bows and arrows. Until those sorts of levels of distrust are dealt with and the population see the army as being somewhat on their side, there you have very little room for manoeuvre, because you can only really go in shooting. You can't go in and talking to people, because they won't listen.
Okay, well, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. We've been discussing the fight against Boko Haram. Next up, we will stay on roughly the same longitude, but we'll be heading east as Sudan's president settles back into his new Chinese-built palace, accommodation certainly preferable to what he might be occupying if the International Criminal Court had its way.
It was designed by a suspect bohemian, houses a coup plotter, and today is favored by young liberal creatives. Madrid's Edificio Princesa is a concrete testament to the contradictions of Spain's transition to democracy, as our correspondent Liam Aldiss discovered.
Today, the building that was once dubbed the bunker by Madrileños is now seen in a very different light, as plant life has progressively engulfed the structure, fulfilling the architect's original vision and providing residents with plenty of verdant balconies. Edificio Princesa is being celebrated as a model of inner city, high density architecture that has withstood the test of time.
On the home front, a photographic portrait now playing in the film section at Monocle.com.
And you're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. We'll turn now to Khartoum, where President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has been sworn in for yet another term. On the face of it, the record that won him 94% of the vote in April could be seen as somewhat mixed. His 26 years in office include a coup d'etat, the harbouring of Carlos the Jackal and Osama bin Laden, a couple of civil wars, the loss of half the country and much of its oil, and his own indictment on genocide charges, while Sudan has remained one of the world's poorest nations. Isabel, it's not an impressive resume, really.
I love people who get 94% of the vote. Except Blatter, really.
Yeah, I'm always keen to meet the other 6%. I always want to know who was that guy. How has he gotten away with it?
Well, the opposition boycott probably helped. It was a low turnout, and there was an opposition boycott. How else he got away with it, I can only imagine. But I'm sure he has a long record of getting quote unquote elected. So that, you know, he's not going to give up at this point.
Indeed, he is. And you would think it would somewhat hobble a campaign for public office having charges from the ICC hanging over you. Although he's not the first to approve that, not necessarily has to be any particular handicap. James, where is he with the ICC at the moment?
So he's still wanted. He's still not meant to travel. There's still there's still a case against him. But the investigations that are taking place and the sort of active pursuing of the case has stopped in December of last year, which isn't because the ICC and the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, have taken another look at the evidence they've gathered and gone, oh God, we've got this all wrong, actually. This Bashir chap's actually rather nice. It's just that they...
Whoops.
Sorry. They can't they can't pursue it any further at this time, and so they're not. My understanding is it's not been thrown out by... The judge isn't pushing them to drop the case entirely, like what happened with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. So he's not under... He is sort of winning against the ICC, apart from the fact that he does have to skulk around in the night sometimes when he's travelling from country to country.
And by some analyses, and I'll put this to you, Isabel, by some analyses, he's actually been made more popular in Sudan by these ICC charges, because he has done that thing, and he's by far from the only African tyrant to have done it, of suggesting that, you know, this is Western justice, that it is unfairly directed at Africans. Does he have, and I hesitate to ask, does he have even half a point?
Well, he does have half a point, leaving aside his own case, which, you know, one shouldn't... call judgment on, but most of the ICC cases have involved Africa,
and every single one.
So that may be because the kind of things that go on in Africa lend themselves to these sort of charges, but it makes it quite easy for and he's not the only African leader who has pointed this out and who does feel that Africa is unfairly targeted by the ICC. His protection, according to Bensouda at least, is the continuing support of China in the UN Security Council, and she has complained that if the Security Council doesn't take a more robust line on this case, then it won't progress. I think that's very unlikely.
Yeah. On that subject, though, and you mentioned China's support for him, and indeed they are the ones who built him his vast and ridiculous new presidential palace. Are China now playing, I guess, a similar role to what we've seen America play in the Middle East and Africa as a perhaps reluctant patron of tyrants on the grounds that, you know, it's the stability fetish? Mm-hmm. And given recent events across the Middle East and North Africa, you know, Bashir may be able to say, well, it's me or what else?
They certainly adopt that argument. They certainly adopt that argument to castigate Western interference, the support for the Arab Spring, etc. Now, China will dislike movements like that for any number of domestic reasons. Don't want that here, thank you very much. But it certainly, in the Sudan, it begins with partly inexperience, but also it's a key resource partner. You know, China needed infinite amounts of energy. It buys it and bought it from a great many unsavory people, as we do. You know, we don't support Saudi Arabia because we admire the democracy and human rights record of Saudi Arabia. We support Saudi Arabia because it's a strategic partner and it sits on a lot of oil. China's in much the same position with Sudan. It's also had a kind of moral position, or if you like, of non-interference in other countries. And you find that very strongly held in emerging economies and in economies that in countries that have been interfered with rather than done the interfering. So on principle, it tends to oppose action of this kind. Certainly the International Criminal Court would not be something China would wish to encourage. Again, partly for reasons of its own, but also on reasons of principle.
Okay, well, we will look finally tonight at Beijing, where it might actually be marginally easier to breathe this week, at least indoors. Smoking has been banned in all public places. Beijing's not the first place to have enacted such a ban, but it may be the one which has had to make the greatest cultural change. More than a third of the city's 11.5 million people are estimated to be smokers. James, first of all, leaving aside the question of enforceability, which we will come to, is there really any argument against this?
Well, the usually rehearsed arguments that people should have the ability to hurt themselves as much as they like, as long as they're not hurting other people. The argument against that, even if you accept that, is that smoking does hurt other people. Speaking as someone who was a smoker and was very opposed to the smoking ban when it came in here, it's been rather positive for me. I didn't actually mind, in retrospect, the nanny state looking after me in this case has helped a bit.
I don't know and have never met a single smoker who would actually actively prefer things to be back the way they were. It does now seem just bizarre that it was permitted to go on in cinemas and restaurants and on the top
and
of buses.
Offices, yeah. Offices.
I know, it's extraordinary. Yeah. Isabel, enforceability in China, in Beijing.
Famously difficult.
It is a big city. It is a chaotic city. It is a city whose, how can I put it? The citizens are not necessarily world famous for their courtesy and sort of just cooperating gently with whatever they may be asked to do. Will they just go along with this?
Well, I think they're rather harder to discipline in this respect than the French are, and that was bad enough. When the French introduced the smoking ban, everyone sort of shrugged and lit up another Gauloise. But there will be a lot of that in Beijing. This is, after all, not the first time it's been tried. It was tried in 2012, and basically people sort of shrugged and gave up. What the government is relying on this time is social media, you know, something that they have mixed feelings about. But in this, they're encouraging people to name and shame, photograph, tweet, Weibo, people who light up inappropriately.
How charmingly cultural revolution of them.
Well, it is rather, isn't it? And, you know, perhaps they'll, you know, ease up on other aspects of social media if this is a success. What you can't count on, I think, are all those little, you know, bar owners and cafe owners asking their customers not to smoke. I honestly don't think that is going to fall easily within, you know, either self-interest or Chinese notions of politeness.
Just a final thought on this, Isabel, and unfortunately a brief one. Is there any argument that this is basically a bit of a diversionary tactic from the Communist Party? Beijing obviously has horrific pollution problems. I mean, I remember being there, God, I was there nearly 15 years ago, and you could barely breathe outside, and I doubt it's improved. Is this a sort of a doing something kind of thing?
To be fair, they're doing quite a lot on air quality. It's going to take a little while. But if you're looking at soaring lung cancer rates, there are obviously two contributors to that. One is the general air quality and the other is smoking. So you can do something about smoking. That doesn't mean they're not doing or trying to do something about air quality.
We will have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and James Schneider, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's show. It's produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jolien Goffin. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli is here with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, our design program, Section D. At 2200 hours, I will be back with Ted Kravitz for the Monocle Daily with further discussion and analysis of Sepp Blatter's resignation about half an hour ago. This show returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. For this edition of Midori House, goodbye. Thanks for listening.